24 years to the day after fashion icon Gianni Versace was gunned down on the front steps of his own South Beach palazzo. That mansion is back in the headlines, and tragedy is once again the story. Two men are dead today from gunshot wounds at that same place. As horrid memories of the 1997 tragedy come flooding back, a live report straight ahead on Banfield. And protests erupting in the streets in Cuba and in Miami and, in fact, around the world. Is this the moment in time when Cuba blinks and the regime even crumbles? And what's happening right now amid the government's media blackout? I'll ask one half of the famous Cuban-American duo, Emilio and Gloria Estefan, tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. 24 years to the day since the shocking murder of fashion icon Gianni Versace on the front steps of his Miami Beach mansion. And two more people have now been found dead there from gunshot wounds. In that very same home, now a posh and expensive hotel. If you were around on July 15th, 1997, when that blockbuster story broke, and if you were in Miami Beach, or even if you weren't, it all came rushing back when you heard today's news. Reporter Brian Enten is live tonight from the Ocean Boulevard Mansion with more on this news. Brian, this is really just an astounding headline, but it is a very different headline than from 24 years ago because there's no manhunt this time around. Take me there and tell me what's happening.
Yeah, I'm glad you're setting it up that way, Ashley, because it is very different than what happened to Gianni Versace in his mansion behind me 24 years ago. The medical examiner today said this is a double suicide, but the timing on this is so strange because it's all unfolding exactly 24 years after Gianni Versace was gunned down on the front steps behind me in the very same place. The latest we're learning from Miami Beach police today is around 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. They first got the call from housekeepers inside this posh boutique hotel. They went inside what's known as the Villa Suite. That is actually Gianni Versace's old bedroom. And when the housekeepers got inside, they found two men dead, a 30-year-old and a 31-year-old man, both shot in the head. Police investigated all night long, and today the conclusion from the medical examiner again was that it is a double suicide. They brought the body bags out the back of the hotel, looked over everything. That's the conclusion they came to. But again, the timing, just very, very strange, Ashley.
So, Brian, here are some of the pictures from today as we see the emergency vehicles there. But those aerial views were showing the bodies coming out of the back door into the alley behind that extraordinary, I think like $1,800 a night luxury hotel. It seemed that there were some crowds out front, but nothing like the day when Gianni Versace was murdered. Take me to the feel of South Beach and how they digested this bizarre, bizarre news.
Yeah, I mean, everybody is talking about it. It's obviously the buzz because everybody knows what happened in the Versace mansion. And then to have this happen exactly 24 years later, it's very, very strange, though. You mentioned, you noticed the video, they brought the body bags out the back of the hotel. And what was so strange is they never really shut this boutique hotel down. The guests were coming and going. There's a very famous Italian restaurant inside. That never shut down. Even as this investigation went on today, we were out here and there was a wedding going on, Ashley.
It is absolutely bizarre, Brian. So, you know, a lot of people watching right now, especially people who were just wrapped in the 8-day frantic search for Versace's killer that ended with Andrew Cunanan and the serial killer's own suicide. A lot of people want to know why. Are they saying anything about why this might be a double suicide? Why on this particular, you know, right at this particular anniversary? Why these two people, who they were and why they were in this hotel?
Yeah, we've been looking into it all day, trying to see, is this just a coincidence, or did this happen on the anniversary for a reason? It's very strange. Both of the men do not have a big social media presence. They're from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. It's unclear why they were in the hotel, but again, this happened inside Gianni Versace's old bedroom, now known as the Villa Suite.
I mean, that is a bizarre detail that you've uncovered as well, and it's just very distressing. But, you know, it's weird, Brian, because I'm looking behind you, and it just seems normal. Does it feel that way?
Yeah, let me step out of the way and show you, Ashley, because, I mean, it's such a beautiful mansion, and you mentioned it. It's a beautiful hotel now, but it does feel weird. I mean, it felt weird yesterday when literally we're watching body bags go out the back of this boutique hotel, formerly the Versace Mansion, and people in the front are taking photos like they are tonight. You see them in the front, and there's literally hotel guests coming and going. People are making dinner reservations. It was almost from the front of the hotel like nothing was going on, yet inside there was this investigation. Now we learn a double suicide.
Brian Enten, excellent work, and thank you for digging on this very strange anniversary, very sad anniversary as well. Thank you for that, Brian, reporting for us live. I now want to welcome someone else who is integrally connected to this story, Charles Podesta. He knows that mansion extraordinarily well, and he knew Gianni Versace extraordinarily well because he was Gianni Versace's executive chef and later his estate manager. And he happened to be in the kitchen the morning shots rang out where his boss was being killed in front of the mansion. You know, Charles, thank you so much for joining us on this very strange occasion. I'm not sure how else to classify it, but I can only imagine what you must have been thinking when you heard this news today.
I heard it yesterday, and I just stopped. You know, my initial thought was what happened. When they say a double suicide, I'm like, you know, why? And then my thoughts go to the spirit of the individuals, their families, their friends. It's just sad. And I don't think there is an explanation. I don't know if we'll ever know.
We may never. And it's also odd that they would choose the eve before today's anniversary. And then, of course, housekeeping, you know, found these bodies in the news, you know, broke publicly today. But there is something that Brian Enten just reported that really caught my ear. And that was that they were found in the Villa Suite, which was Gianni Versace's bedroom. Would that have been obvious to someone checking in? Would they be able to ask for that particular room if they were checking in or making a reservation?
I would think so. I've been to the property since, you know, recently, I'd say probably 6-7 months ago. I know the manager of the property there, the Victor Hotel owners own the property. You can Google it to see what that room is. I know the room very well. It's the upper third floor to the right, because the left-hand side would have been the living room section to the suite, and then it wrapped around to the bathroom and then to the bedroom. I don't know if they did it for notoriety, if they did it for to make a statement or to go out in a blaze of glory like Andrew Cunanan wanted to go out, leave the earth that way. Again, no one knows. It's tragic all the way around and horrific, horrible, just horrible.
And, you know, Charles, it's such a different scene. This is a live picture out front of, you know, Gianni's former home, now a hotel. And it's business as usual. But I am old enough to remember the frantic manhunt after Gianni had gone to get his newspaper at the News Cafe, not far down the street, and then was killed on those front steps. And the next 8 days, I mean, take me back to those 8 days and just how frightened everyone was about who did it.
You know, shocking. The whole thing happened so fast that morning. I was in the kitchen, actually. Normally, Mr. Versace never went out of the house that early. That was very unusual. He and Alberta, our housekeeper, and I were in the kitchen. He came in and he said to me in Italian, "You vado fuori a fare le spese." which means I'm going out shopping. And I looked at him. Normally he goes out with Antonio, his boyfriend, his lover. And I looked at him. He kind of just a strange look, I guess. And he says, no, I'm just going to go buy magazines. Now, during that period of time, we had someone in the house that did that. They went down to the news cafe and bought the Italian newspapers. But that day he wanted to get magazines. And so we don't know what magazines he saw, didn't see, or wanted. So I didn't really think anything of it. He went out. We lived a very open life there. It was like a Shangri-La. It was a beautiful, beautiful time, a beautiful life, a beautiful home. And then when I was in the kitchen, I heard noise. Sounded like a backfire. And I went out to the pool area first from the kitchen doors. Didn't see anything, but I heard the dining room chairs fly back. The dining room was in the front part of the first floor to the left as you look at the house. And the door to the dining room ran open. And I followed Antonio and his guest, who had come over to play tennis with him, out to the front. And I got to the steps. And that's when I realized something was horribly wrong. I did not go any further than that. In my mind, I just said, we need help. And that's when I went to the telephone and made the 911 call. And the whole time I was making the 911 call, what I was trying to do is stay as calm as I could, try to get the information that was needed to rescue to come. And the rescue was right down the street on 11th Street, literally four or five blocks from us. And it just seemed to me like an eternity before I heard the sirens come. And then, of course, they came and they put him in the ambulance. And after that, my immediate thought was, no one's going to the hospital with him. I should go because I'm sure the doctor's going to ask, did he eat? Is he on medication? All the above, you know, that a doctor would want. And I also had a cousin that worked at Jackson Memorial Hospital, and I was on the phone with them on the way to the hospital to say, please meet me in the emergency room. And so I went there to be whatever assistance I could. And then when I got there, they put me away in a room, and then the doctor came in and started telling me that he didn't make it. And that was like, I was like out of body experience watching the doctor's mouth move. I wasn't really comprehending what he was saying. And then I just kind of quietly snuck out of the hospital and went back to the house. And it was just the following week was just unbelievable, to say the least.
You know, Charles, we have that moment where you dialed 911. I want to play that for our viewers who may not have known about you being an integral part of the police, you know, arriving there. Have a listen.
He was entering his house. We just heard gunshots. We went outside. He's on the steps of the house. Who would have done something like that?
It's a very short piece of that 911 call, but I can only imagine after 24 years, Charles, that this is a hard anniversary for you to get past and, you know, to have this happen. You know, I'm not sure how you're processing, but I hope you're okay.
No, I'm okay. I deal with it well, and I don't call any death a death. I call it a transcending, that we transcend from this to the next, whatever the next should be. I know, and I can share this with you and your audience. Mr. Versace lived a wonderful life. He was always very, very happy. His spirit was alive. And as Anna Wintour said, so well at the memorial service in the Egyptian part of the Metropolitan Museum in New York, that I believe I'm trying to paraphrase what she said, but I believe that the angels in heaven are no longer just wearing plain white. And that really kind of took the room that was in very, very sad room into a little bit better mind frame.
I mean, his impact there was Princess Diana with Elton John at his memorial. He was 50 years old when he was dead. Charles Podesta, thank you so much for joining us on this very sad occasion. And I appreciate you taking the time to share a little more about Gianni Versace. Coming up, some shocking new developments in a murder case that we thought was over. A man was arrested, tried, convicted of a college student's murder. But now, on the day that he was due to be sentenced for the killing of Molly Tibbetts, this case might actually be slipping away. Tell you why next. Welcome back. I have to say, when I heard this, my jaw dropped. These are pretty shocking developments in a story you probably know, the Molly Tibbetts murder case. I know you will remember this. She's the college student in Iowa who disappeared while on a jog back in July of 2018. And over the next several weeks, police in multiple states investigated hundreds of leads. And then a month later, after she disappeared, they found her body. And she wasn't far from where she vanished. She was in a cornfield covered in corn stalks. Police were smart about this. They went right to it. They used surveillance video to identify a car. A black car that was seen following Tibbetts on her jog that day. That led them to arrest a 24-year-old undocumented worker named Christian Bahena Rivera. He was tried and convicted of Tibbetts' murder, and he was scheduled to be sentenced today. But that's not the news I'm bringing you. Bet you thought you were going to find out what he was going to get. No, instead, I'm going to bring you something that is very, very strange. An inmate, better known in my business as a jailhouse snitch, has introduced a whole different scenario to explain how Tibbetts died. He says that he had a cellmate, they always do, and this former cellmate's name was Gavin Jones. And this jailhouse snitch says that Gavin Jones made some statements that he, Gavin Jones, not Christian Rivera, killed Tibbetts along with another man. Gavin Jones allegedly said that Tibbetts had been kidnapped and may have been held in a so-called trap house. If you don't know what a trap house is, it's a building that's used to hold sex trafficking victims. And now, Christian Rivera, already convicted of Tibbetts' murder, has offered up a whole other scenario of his own that takes details from both of these stories. Hold on to your hat and maybe grab a soda. Rivera says that two men came along and ambushed him in his trailer on the day that Tibbetts disappeared. And those two men forced him to drive them around while they looked for Tibbetts. I'm confused too. Then Rivera says one of the men, armed with a knife, got out of the car and just disappeared for 10 minutes. Presumably, Rivera can see out the windows, but that's as far as he goes. He does say, though, that when that man returned, both men ordered him to drive a short distance and stop the car. Rivera then says he heard some movement in the car and the trunk closed. Again, I presume since he's driving, he could see out the windows, but no further explanation of this. The men then ordered him to drive to a white house where they took his keys and cell phone and then left, but warned him not to talk. And they threatened his family if he did. If you think it's strange, I am not done. In fact, I'm not even getting started. Rivera says after the two men left, he waited for some time and then decided, I'm going to take a peek in the trunk. That's when he says he saw Tibbetts' body. But then he says he was worried he'd be implicated in this crime. So he says he just scooped up that body out of the trunk and marched off to a cornfield and covered her up in corn stalks. I'm confused as well, because if those people had warned you, would you really just make off with the body? That's what he said he did. So police located him a month later, and they interrogated him for 11 hours. And during that 11-hour interrogation, he told police that he, in fact, had encountered Tibbetts while jogging and that she threatened to call the police on him. I'm not exactly sure what encountered means in his books, but that's what he said. He also said he panicked and blacked out, but that when he came to, what? What are these headphones doing in my car? And what's that body doing in my trunk? And then decided, well, I better bring her to the cornfield and cover her up. You okay? I'm not. I'm not okay at all, because this sounds like, well, I can't say it on television, but you know where I'm going. Because if you're counting, this is now at least three or maybe four different scenarios for how that beautiful young woman died. And yet the judge decided to delay the sentencing today. And now there might even be some talk of an appeal, possibly even a new trial. Wait, that's jumping way ahead, because in my business, that doesn't just happen. I think we all need to take a breath. We all need some clarity on this, and I have just the people. I want to bring in News Nation's Michael Schur, who's been following this case very closely. Michael, Did I get anything wrong in that setup? Because as a legal journalist, that sounds like bull cocky.
Yeah, I was wondering what you were going to come back with as a word, Ashley. You didn't get anything wrong, but there's even more to it. So as I was listening to you say all of these things, the defense attorneys are there, right? And you're the legal expert, not this reporter, but they're there to create reasonable doubt. And that seems to be what's going on right now. I mean, even listening to you list those sort of circumstances makes me think, well, you know, who's right here? There's so many possibilities. But there's more to it, right? I mean, there is this trap house that you mentioned. And a trap house is, it's called a trap house because people literally get trapped there. People who are on drugs, who are addicted, will go there, get free drugs from the person who runs the trap house. And then that's where the sex trafficking happens. They have people come in and they prostitute these women out to other men. And those men pay the trap house for it. So it's very hard to leave because you get the free drugs and you get free reign there. But it's also a very terrible place for any young woman or any woman or any person to be in. But that's why they're called trap houses, because you're literally trapped in them. There's another woman who was 2 months before Molly Tibbetts, who was at a Casey's in the same town. Casey's is a popular it's 7-Eleven convenience store known for their pizzas and food as well in Iowa and probably more of the Midwest, but I've been to them in Iowa. And she was abducted from a Casey's. She was then found by an officer on Route 92 there, brought in for questioning. She says she was at a trap house and she overheard other people speaking. The man whose trap house that she ended up in was James Lowe. Now, James Lowe is a 50-year-old who is now in custody on another charge in Iowa. And James Lowe is important here because his ex-girlfriend is the mother of another name I'm going to give you here. There's a missing 11-year-old boy.
Is that Xavier Harrelson?
Exactly, Xavier Harrelson. Yes, Xavier Harrelson.
It gets crazier, Michael Schur.
So there are all these lines that connect so many people in this case now.
Very convergent. I want to stop down and take a quick break because I need a drink. And when I come back, I actually want to bring in some pretty smart legal minds, actually the best of the minds that I work with. Mark O'Mara and Susan Filan are going to break this down as well to let us know, I think, the ultimate question. Does he have a shot? It's next. Convicted of murdering Molly Tibbetts actually get a whole second crack at this case? I'm joined by former prosecutor Susan Filan and also criminal defense attorney and civil rights attorney Mark O'Mara. It's good to see both of you. Mark, I'm gonna lead you off on this one. You heard the crazy, and when I say crazy, I'm not using hyperbole here, this crazy concoction of a jailhouse snitch and then a girlfriend of the jailhouse snitch and then the defendant himself putting a whole new scenario into the plate, and a judge has to delay the sentencing today to decide what to do in a few days?
Well, I actually think that Judge Yates did the right thing. What he did was he said he put everything on pause and said, look, if there are these issues, as outlandish as they may turn out to be, or as substantive as they may turn out to be, let's look at them now. Let's give the defense some time to go on their expedition, whether it's a fishing expedition, a hunting expedition, or if they actually find something. I think it was a smart move not to rush forward with sentencing today, realizing that all of this is out there. Because if you look at it from a slightly different perspective than the one that you gave, you know, you do have this trap house. You do have somebody saying about a jailhouse snitch, talking about what he said. You do have this former girlfriend saying it in a different context. There were some different unrelated people talking similar stories about what may have happened. So will it overturn it? No, I don't believe so with the length and the depth of the evidence that we saw when both you and I were watching this trial unfold. But I do think it was a good move to take a breath, do it the right way, look into everything so that if you get a sentencing, we know an appeal is coming. In effect, the judge will insulate himself from appellate issues by doing it right today.
Well, there was some pretty darn compelling evidence in the trial of Christian Rivera. Susan Filan, you've been on both sides of the courtroom as a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and you've also seen your fair share of really high-profile trials. We've worked on them together. In this particular circumstance, is it unfair if I say the following? Jailhouse snitches and trap house proprietors and trap house visitors make really crappy evidentiary witnesses.
Yes, they do, but they're still witnesses. And I have to agree that the judge had no choice but to delay the sentencing. There was absolutely no way, given what has come out, that the sentencing could take place today. And he's going to take this step by step. The next motion that he's going to hear is whether the state has to turn over what the defense is claiming is exculpatory evidence. If there is exculpatory evidence that has not been turned over, that's an error that has to be corrected. And if it can be corrected at this level, rather than go all the way through the system, which would be he's sentenced, then there's an appeal, then it's overturned, then it's perhaps a retrial. The judge is doing it the right way and in the right sequence. After the hearing is decided on whether the state has to turn over evidence to the defense, we'll see what happens next. But it is possible, in my view, that there is a new trial granted. And my question is, what would that mean if the defendant's role in this wasn't to kill, but to just deliver the body to the cornfield? That's not murder. If he participated in the murder under duress, you know, at gunpoint to his head, is that murder? So my question is, depending on how the evidence comes out, what does that mean for his role in this case?
So, Mark O'Meara, if let's just jump ahead and for, you know, for kicks, let's say there's going to be another trial. Let's say this conviction's overturned and the prosecutors will buy everybody lunch if they don't, but will prosecute again. Sure. A jury's going to hear the story that Mr. Rivera decided after all this duress, and I think there's something in the trunk, and they've just threatened my family if I tell anyone, he's just decided to go and look in the trunk and pick up a, I don't know, 130-pound, I'm guessing, body, and just hoof it in the nighttime to a cornfield because, I don't know, I mean, the preposterousness of that, to me, is a jury saying, yeah, that's just beyond reasonable doubt. Like, it's beyond reasonable doubt.
Yeah, they're not going to let him go in a subsequent trial because they now believe his story. The only way that he, if he gets a new trial based upon that premise, that there was enough evidence there that wasn't turned over, that the state sort of hid or should have given more information. If for some reason the judge says, you're going to get to talk about the trap house, you're going to get to talk about Jones, you're going to get to talk about all these things you want to talk about to the new jury. Even if all of that happens, what the defense cannot get around is the preposterous nature of the story that he gave. So if it's going to happen, the only thing they're going to do is come out with an alternative theory, in effect, that the defense can convince. I don't care what he made up to try and evidence non-guilt to the previous jury. This is conclusive evidence that this guy did it, that Jones did it, that this other person did it. If they can find that type of evidence, then what he said doesn't matter.
Yeah, the whole Gavin Jones thing just sounds really preposterous as well. But listen, I only have 10 seconds left. But honestly, Susan, I hope that the family, you know, of Molly Tebbets are being treated with kid gloves. Just give me 10 seconds on that if you can, because I know you know.
This has to be absolutely excruciating for the family, and my heart goes out to them. And this isn't a game. This isn't gotcha. This isn't who wins. This is justice, and this is a search for the truth. And I hope that justice is done in this case as much for the defendant as for the victim and her family. And my heart does go out to them, and I do offer my condolences. But I want to reassure them that this is one of the greatest justice systems in the world, and it is at work. We're watching watching it unfold.
Thank you, Susan Filan. Thank you, Mark O'Meara. Still to come, is Cuba about to free itself for the first time in more than 60 years? Is that possible? One of the most famous Cuban Americans, Emilio Estefan, joins me next. You know, Miami is a really fun place, but it has been nothing short of electrified this month. And it's all because of what is happening 90 miles south of the state of Florida in Cuba. And if you haven't seen the photos, it is historic. The protesters have jammed the streets with this
This is not what you see in Cuba. Like never. What's really remarkable is that a highway was shut down for hours in Miami in support of these folks down south of them. Not just happening here in the U.S. either. There's protests going on all around the world. And it really does feel like a major cultural and political shift may be happening in Cuba. Or is it? I'm joined by someone whose name is synonymous with Cuban culture and the Free Cuba movement. Grammy Award-winning musician and producer Emilio Estefan. Emilio Estefan, thank you for joining me on this. You are a definitive voice because you and your wife, Gloria Estefan, have produced music over the years. You feel like the Cuban culture in Florida. Did you feel pressure because of your leading role in the Cuban community to really come out strongly and voice your leadership in what's happening in Cuba?
I don't think it's pressure. I mean, thank you for having us. I mean, you know something? It's so difficult, you know, because we know the real truth about Cuba for so many years, 60 years. And you know something? I think the worst enemy right now of Cuba has been the technology. For the first time, we'll be able to see some images of, you know, of some of the beating and the everything they've done for human rights. And you know something? That people are desperate. I mean, desperate because, you know, it's not about food. It's not about anything else. It's about freedom. I mean, you know, be able to choose your president. You'll be able to, you have a difference with the government. They take you away. And one of the things that people, they don't know is when you do something in Cuba, you disagree with the government. They punish your daughter or your mom, and they take it away, and it disappears. And, you know, it's incredible. I mean, some of the things that, you know, that when I was in Cuba, I was 11 years old, when they came to my house, and they looking for dollars, and they almost beat my mom. And, you know, I that's what I made the decision to leave Cuba. And released it, you know, when I went to Spain, because my mom was from Spain, you know, I became almost homeless because, you know, we didn't have a way to make a living because we wasn't allowed to work. So, you know, to see this, I'm so, you know, I see a little bit of light. Of course, it's difficult because, you know, showing this image because we have no support. I mean, internet, they should be coming with keeping the internet so people can be able to show this to the world. But they already disconnect that. And they took a lot of electricity and they have, you know, people have to stay home now. It's a major problem.
So, Emilio, I have to be honest. I have watched the news on this all week and I was desperate to get a voice like you to answer one question I really don't feel has been answered accurately. And that is, why all of a sudden, why did everybody feel that they could get together and get out on the street and be vocal and get on camera and shake their fists in Cuba? That has never happened. And it is terrifying. But something propelled them all at one moment to feel like there was enough unity and message among all of them to make it out into the streets. Some people have said COVID, but I just don't think COVID, you know, led to Monday. What was it that it happened all at once?
I'm going to tell you that what happens because people have phones now in Cuba. People that come from Miami bring a lot of phones and they have internet. They communicate themselves and say, okay, people are protesting in Havana and this protesting over there. So, you know, people, they know what's going on now. I mean, for example, I was laughing today that the Cuban government used some of these protests and they changed the sound like people are marching for the government. And you say, Cuba, Cuba, but, you know, it's really against, you know, they're asking for freedom, freedom. And they change some of the sound. People are, like I said, technology has been like so incredible for freedom because, you know, people get to see some of the reality of the abuse. Of course, what happened with the abuse, you get to see people in Havana, like 200 people, and they ask for other people to enjoy it, and then becomes like, you know, I think it's been, like I said, a little bit of light, you know, for freedom. I hope that, you know, we get some support for the president. I've been talking to the White House, and I recommend them to see if we can get some of the prisoners that it's been here in Miami to explain to the president how difficult it is. I mean, what is the lie about the embargo? Cuba has no embargo. If you go to Cuba with daughter, you can go to a store and buy anything you want. Now, if you go with peso, you have to stay and buy whatever they give you. I mean, sometimes they give a little piece of rice. Everything is like a little booklet. And with the booklet, you get what the government tells you that you are allowed to eat. So realistically, I think they lie so much through the years that I think, you know, for the first time, we see reality.
Emilio, I'm so curious. Obviously, you know, the Cuban government shut down internet service. They shut down a lot of phone service. It's very, very hard to know after these last few days now what's happening. It's all great that we have those pictures, that we saw that they were brave and they went out into the streets. But then came the arrests, and there's not as many pictures of that. And I don't know if you've got special communication. By the way, after the break, I'm going to ask you about that White House discussion that you had. But do you have any special communication where you're able to know, because you have this position in the Cuban community, what's happening there now?
No, I mean, some people we're trying to help and send, like, you know, sort of a ways to communicate. But, you know, people are desperate. I mean, for example, one of my friends and his mom disappeared. He went to protest and they took her away for 4 days. And he calls, it's no answer. We don't know what happened to her. And that's why the people are going so crazy. I feel so bad for, you know, when you have a family and you know that, you know, something can happen today the way they've done to many people. I remember my cousin left to an embassy when he was 20 years old, and my aunt didn't know that he was leaving. So they came in the morning and said, you know, he was leaving. I said, no, I didn't know he was leaving. They put her in jail for 20 years to punish him.
What?
Yes. I mean, that happens in Cuba constantly. And, you know, people, I mean, some need so much ignorance when they talk about the embargo. The reality is not embargo. They get things from Spain, from Brazil, from Turkey, from Russia. Wow. I mean, you know, the excuse about the whole situation about the embargo. Like I said, if you can go to Cuba right now, from the state, if I bring dollars, I can go to any store, especially for tourists, and I can buy anything. Like you go to any grocery store here in America. Now, Cuban people, it's not allowed. Cuban people is not allowed to go to a hotel even when you come.
So it's a very different picture if you visit Cuba. You're not getting the real experience. I had that same experience in the Soviet Union, things I could do that everybody else couldn't. But my question is, do you know what's happening in the streets? Like, do you have any idea if those robust protests are gone and quelled? And do you know if there have been hundreds or thousands of arrests? Do you have any idea what now? Because we feel like we're in a bit of a blackout.
I know it's a blackout because, you know, that's what they usually do when everything like that happens. But the only thing that we know, they brought a lot of reinforced from the Venezuela. They're beating people all like you can believe. We saw somebody, captured when they killed the guy in front of his kid. And he beat him to death. I mean, it's incredible to see. I'm telling you, the abuse that you see, I mean, you're going to get a lot more. I just saw a couple of videos that somebody sent. You know, some people kept song, believe it or not, they do portable things with the internet and they build things. People, Cuban people with the necessity, they do a lot of, they are very creative. I just saw a couple of things, how they beat a woman. I mean, because she was protesting saying freedom. Just if you say the word freedom, forget it. You can be in a big problem.
Okay, well, when we come back after the break, I want to drill down on that discussion you said you had with the White House. I can't wait to find out, A, what you said, and B, if it was received. So after the break, more with Emilio Estefan, one of the de facto leaders of the Cuban community here in the United States. Back after this. Shocking, surprising, eye-opening, all of those things apply to the anti-government protests that just suddenly erupted in Cuba, a place where that does not happen. They also erupted in Miami and all around the world, places that does happen. I'm joined by Grammy Award-winning musician and Cuban-American activist Emilio Estefan. I say the de facto leader in the Cuban-American community, Emilio. I want to just play for our audience two different presidents of the United States and their different approaches to Cuban foreign policy, because, you know, what's happening in Cuba has bedeviled American foreign policy for decades. But here is President Trump and President Obama, and spot the difference. Take a look.
Today, as part of our continuing fight against communist oppression, I am announcing that the Treasury Department will prohibit U.S. travelers from staying at properties owned by the Cuban government. We're also further restricting the importation of Cuban alcohol and Cuban tobacco. My administration stands with every citizen of Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela in their fight for liberty, and we work for the day when this will become a fully free hemisphere.
Good afternoon. Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. and the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years. We will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
Okay, Emilio Estefan, this is a two-pronged question. Which approach is more suitable to the Cuban-American community as they look south to Cuba? And we've got a new guy in the White House, Joe Biden, and you've just had White House visits. So start with what you spoke of in the White House and end with which approach is better.
Well, I want to tell you, I produced 43 events in the White House, 43, six different presidents. And I've been involved with every single one. And I think they always have the best intention. To tell you the truth, it's going to the doctor and give you two different diagnoses to see which one is going to work. Either one work. Because I think the approach that Trump took was a lot more stronger than the one Obama, President Obama took. Obama was the field of thinking that, you know, he was opening, he was bringing a lot of hope. But I told him, when I met with him, a week before he went to Cuba, I told him that dealing with the communists is no way you're going to win. President Trump, which I know, he did a lot of great things about going to Cuba and everything. But realistically, you know, people kept going from Miami and bringing money and bringing things and supporting because it's their family. So I think realistic, never has been a president that has been firm about the situation with Cuba. They talk about the embargo, but the embargo has been totally alive for many, many years. And you know what happens? I think the Cuban regime used that as a publicity to confuse people. I mean, I think both wanted to do something good, but I don't think it helped really, definitely the reality. What is helped now, right now, I mean, Cuba, the people, they don't have guns, they don't have how to defend themselves. The only thing they have right now is the internet. I think the thing
well,
has to be...
and barely, Cuba. Sir, I mean, honestly, barely the internet. It's been shut off. I'm just so curious about your whether you feel hopeful after your White House meeting. Do you feel hopeful that policy will be effective under the Biden administration?
Well, I didn't have a meeting, but I called the White House. I talked to Marco Rubio. We talked to everybody. We're asking the president, please, to say, I mean, he did a great statement about, you know, that he supported freedom in Cuba, and we really appreciate that. We need more. The only thing that we need is him to force them to keep the internet so that people can know the reality of what is happening in Cuba. I think that will be incredible. I hope he can meet with some people that, you know, that they killed their families. Remember, we're 90 miles away. 90 yeah. miles away for 60 years, and the abuse has been horrible.
It is horrible. So close, and yet it is so incredibly far. But Emilio Estefan, thank you so much for spending the time with us. I appreciate, revisit this. Because it is a critical topic for all of Americans. I just want to mention you've got the Foundation for Human Rights in Cuba. You'll be releasing a song titled Libertad or Freedom and an accompanying video. Thank you again, and please give our love to your beautiful wife. Hopefully she can join you on the interview next time.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thank you.